government, music, art, health, science, theology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this December the 18th on the West Coast, now December the 19th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. Mountain Time is on the way to catching up. Got another hour. Let's welcome all those that are listening on Wind Talkers Radio Network, independent stations around the world, throughout the United States, Canada, Europe, Asia, Australia, New Zealand, and Central and South America. Where did I forget? Oh, we've probably got some folks listening out in Hawaii as well. And we are on satellite, I'm told, so if you've got a way to figure out how to listen to Evident Footprints or BBSRadio.com on satellite, you probably hear the show there, too. There's an interesting piece of information that Dr. Mike Castle sent me this evening, and I thought I would share this with you. It seems the spin hits all fronts, and this is another example of some spin. This is an article which came out of Paris, France, via the Herald de Paris. And their motto is L'actualité disponible partout. Think about that if you understand French. This is the truth all the way through and through. Previously undiscovered ancient city found on Caribbean sea floor. This is by Jess Alexander, written on December the 9th, 2009, and published December the 16th of that same year. That happens to be this year. Washington, D.C. Exclusive. Researchers have revealed the first images from the Caribbean seafloor of what they believe are the archaeological remains of an ancient civilization. Guarding the location's coordinates carefully, the project's leader, who wishes to remain anonymous at this time, as most leaders do, by the way, says that was my insertion there, that's not in the article, says the city could be thousands of years old, possibly even predating the ancient Egyptian pyramids at Giza. The site was found using advanced satellite imagery and is not in any way associated with the alleged site found by Russian explorers near Cuba in 2001 at a depth of 2,300 feet. To be seen on satellite, our site is much shallower. The team is currently seeking funding to mount an expedition to confirm and explore what appears to be a vast underwater city. And this is a quote here. You have to be careful working with satellite images in such a location, the project's principal researcher said. The digital matrix sometimes misinterprets its data and shows ruins as solid masses. The thing is, we found structure, what appears to be a tall, narrow pyramid, large platform structures with small buildings on them. We've even found standing parallel post and beam construction in the rubble of what appears to be a fallen building. You can't have post and beam without human involvement. Asked if the city is the legendary city of Atlantis, the researchers immediately said no. The romanticized ideal of Atlantis probably never existed, nor will anyone ever strap on a scuba tank, jump in the water, and find a city gateway that says, "Welcome to Atlantis." However, we do believe that the city may have been one of many cities of an advanced, seafaring, trade-based civilization, which may have been visited by their Eurocentric counterparts. Now, I'm going to comment on that and say, I don't know how you can deduce that they're seafaring people by the collapse of what appears to be a skyscraper. But nonetheless, they came to that conclusion. On with the article. It is unknown at this time how the city came to be on the seafloor and not only on dry land. We have several theories. Uh-oh, conspiracy theories. Watch out. The team hopes to conduct a massive mapping and research expedition to learn as much as possible about who these people were before turning the site over to the Caribbean Islands home government. Well, now we know it's in the Caribbean, and we know that there's a government there. We can feel safe. Whatever we found does not belong to us, the project's leader said. It belongs to the people of this island and to the world at large. If any pieces are brought to the surface, they belong in the hands of a museum. Oh, would it be the Rockefellers by any chance? The project team asks that for more information or to find out how to help fund their research, please contact the Herald de Paris publisher, Jess Alexander, at a specially set up telephone number. And that number is, this is a public service announcement here, I don't normally do this, 415-738-7811. Again, if you wish to find out if you can or should contribute to this endeavor, area code 415-738-7811. Sounds like it's in San Francisco. Cause for alarm right there. So I thank Dr. Mike Castle for sending that to me. And I think we may end up discussing this a little bit tonight with our guest. He is our regular Friday night guest. He's been my weekly guest, and I've nominated him our resident science advisor for a very good reason. He's a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, and my good friend, Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to Evident Footprints.
Why, thank you, Don. It's a pleasure to be with you, as usual. That's a very interesting opening article, by the way.
Is it?
Well, for me it is.
Isn't it this interesting that they have to somehow make the proposition of a continent called Atlantis that most people who know anything about ancient history agree existed? They have to make this some insane idea that someone would even bring that up. They didn't use that language, but the implication that people that talk about Atlantis are off their rockers is insulting, to say the least.
Well, not only that, but there's no reason to jump to that conclusion.
Yeah.
There is so much that we don't know about this planet, and the mere fact that they found this city is a good indication of the fact that that statement is accurate.
Uh-huh.
You know, the other thing that's interesting, at least to me, because I happen to know a fair amount about Atlantis, not only did I live there at one point, but I've been studying it most of my life, or at least looking for information about it, and the interesting thing is, the so-called Atlanteans never referred to it as Atlantis. If anything is made up about it, it's probably the name.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, in the latter period of the Atlantean cycle, if you want to call it that, the tragedy that befell that land broke it up into a series of islands. And one of the larger remaining islands was referred to as Poseidus, in honor of the god Poseidon.
Uh-huh.
The name Atlantis is actually associated with the Atlantic Ocean, and it was very probably invented by by Plato when he wrote about the lost continent.
Uh-huh.
But the mere fact that it's in the proper area, by the way, because it was definitely not in the Mediterranean, at least suggests to me that they found something interesting. The architecture and the size of the blocks, or the size of the building material, will tell a great deal. So it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds. It would also be interesting to see if we ever hear about it again.
Yeah. I thought of a great name for this for Atlantis. We could call it Washington Deep Sea. Little tongue-in-cheek there.
Well, you know...
I'm in one of those moods tonight, Jim, I have to say.
That's quite all right. I can take it. Yeah, the interesting thing is that, you know, these cycles do tend to repeat themselves. And nothing would be more interesting to see waves rolling in over Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that actually the meaning of the word cycle, repeating itself?
Yeah, but I wanted to stress that point because, you know, people lose sight of these meanings. You know, they might confuse it with a bicycle, for instance.
Yes. Well, Jim, we didn't really plan anything formally, yet you and I had a chance to discuss what we might talk about. And I have been through a week from hell, but it has, in the last couple of days, just been an absolute joy to be involved in genealogical research. As tedious as it can be, and as frustrating as it could be because of the amount of obfuscation, here we're talking about hiding the name of a continent. Like to know the name somehow is going to enable me or you or any of our listeners to just jump in the ocean and go look for this place. You know, there's all this secrecy, and it became very aware to me in a grander fashion, sort of in an expansive way, that history is really a farce. It really, really is a farce. And the lengths that the powers that be have gone to over the years to hide their identities, to hide their intentions, their motives, their secrets, it's mind-boggling in a way, and yet I think it's the only way they know how to function. They don't know how to function, or they didn't know how to function, and currently I see the same thing, so I guess it's proper to say they don't know how to function in the arena of truth. They just don't know how to do it. It's the furthest thing from their consciousness. It's the furthest thing from their minds. It's in a way, it's really an insult even to their own descriptions of who they are. You know, they call themselves illuminated, and yet you know, a fire is a sense of, or a sort of illumination. A fire out of control is an undesirable type of illumination. It's very destructive, and yet what they do in constructing this paradigm or this matrix for the rest of the world to follow, they trip all over themselves. And I've become quite adept at circumventing the landmines that they've laid out to hide all their dirty deeds and all the corruption that's gone on through millennia. And it's, I feel it would be heartening for me and probably some of our listeners if we were to touch upon some issues of consciousness, because we can apply history, recorded history, to consciousness. And when we do, guess what? Recorded history doesn't stand up to it. Consciousness wins out every time. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, my God. Well, that's quite a question, because I have a myriad of thoughts on that. I could write a book on it. But let's say that in order to address that subject with not only accuracy but distinction, we should travel back to the other side of the Atlantic and across the Mediterranean as well, to the land of Egypt. And the reason why I say that is because there are many great civilizations that have been found in the past. I mean, we could name dozens of them. They all left their mark on the world. But there's something absolutely unique about the impact that Egypt has had on the psyche of man. And even the Greeks will admit that most of what they learned and propagated forward in time came from the Egyptians. And so what is it that they had that was so incredible that it would leave this enduring mark on the human experience? And if you ponder that and read about that very thing, it turns out that they have a certain handle on this phenomenon that we call consciousness, which actually was used by them to engineer things. And Shuala de Lubitz spent his whole life studying this phenomenon and wrote many books on the subject. And during its heyday, Egypt would have been an absolutely amazing place for modern man to visit, because you would enter into a place and immediately be assaulted by so much harmonic activity in so many planes of existence that your consciousness would be elevated whether you liked it or not. And that's a pretty amazing statement. It has been said that the design of temples, the buildings alone, were capable of elevating the consciousness, and that these effects are still in existence today when some of the refurbished temples are visited by people from other lands. They actually wind up with a sense of awe and a sense of divinity, or something at least higher than themselves, that fills them with an emotion that causes them to gravitate in a direction that they would normally not explore, particularly, you know, in our Western society. And so what is this? I mean, what are we talking about here? What do we know about the Egyptians anyway in terms of their real philosophies and their real pursuits? Egyptologists have discovered a lot of wonderful things, but they really, in some instances, they really miss the boat when it comes to the real psyche of the people that they're investigating, because they have this terrible form of prejudice that says that they have to be interpreted in light of our understanding of things, and our understanding of things have to be superior to them because they were in an earlier time. And just having that unfortunate point of view precludes them from finding some of the most incredible secrets that these ancient societies and cultures like Egypt had to offer. So if we get down off our high horse and we look at what was really there through the eyes of someone who spent a lifetime, for instance, like Shuala de Lubitz, investigating this culture, you start to see things in another light. The most important thing is that the Egyptians believed in one God. It's a common misbelief that they had hundreds of gods. They didn't. The thing that's interesting about these so-called gods were they had names for all sorts of things, and they personalized these facets of nature, forces and effects were all given names and treated in a manner that we assume was indicative of deities. But in reality, they knew full well that there was only one creative force. And the interesting thing is that they believed that this creative entity could be known to a certain extent by understanding and knowing his qualities. And the interesting thing about that is that they realized that that cannot be achieved through the logical mind. It has to be done through the other type of mind which human beings have, and that is the artistic, the seat of judgment, the seat of emotion, which is residing in the opposite side of the brain. And this is one of the reasons why, although they had forms of written language, they used hieroglyphs, because symbols automatically reach the intuitive side of the brain and therefore have a resonance with the mind that the written word cannot achieve. And symbols also allow us to integrate both parts of the brain simultaneously if they're prepared properly. And because they engage a different part of the brain, the part of the mind that is nonlinear or not restrained by logical thought, this is probably where the higher self actually resides. And so it becomes very evident if you study this particular civilization through the eyes of someone who spent an entire lifetime investigating it from an out-of-the-box perspective, that these people already had a handle on consciousness that we don't have. And you know, it brings up a myriad of interesting questions like, well, where do they get it from? Well, one thing that you have to bear in mind is that the Egyptian civilization is thousands of years old, and we here in the West are really not that old when you consider the fact that it's a fragmented experience to be a Westerner. The United States is 200 and something years old. Europe is, you know, had its heyday and continues to persist into modern times. The Greeks were around for a while, but the Egyptians persisted as a unique civilization for a very long period of time. And it's true that they were invaded in latter years by the Romans, the Greeks, and other people. But in their earlier part, they go very far back into time. And as such, living under the conditions that they did, with the philosophies that they had in an isolated area, they were in a position to evolve a whole different way of looking at reality and of trying to understand how they as individuals fit into this reality. So the basic message of all of this, I guess, Don, is that the basis of Egyptian symbolism suggests that in man lies the ultimate representation of the created universe. And this concept carries with it an inverse idea that suggests that the universe was created for man to perceive and for God to experience through man. So when you stop and think about that, that is a really, really deep and wonderful thought, which you will never find in a modern religious philosophy, because it's almost bordering on what modern-day religion would term as blasphemous. But the fact of the matter is that this whole concept of consciousness hinges on the fact that it has a function. And not only is that function something which elevates the experience of being human, but if we look at the way the universe really appears to work, it also suggests that it affects the deity that made it. And you would be forced to ask the question, well, what is it all for? And I think that it's a win-win situation. What happens is that as each soul departs this world, it essentially brings a lifetime of experience in an energy format back to the Supreme Being, who then interprets this or digests it or assimilates it or does something with it which allows him to be affected by the experience of one of the creatures that he made. And if we imagine that this is going on throughout billions and billions of worlds throughout the cosmos, there's an endless stream of different beings reporting back their life experiences to one central creation. And therefore, the deity is essentially enjoying an expansion of its own consciousness through all of these participating beings who deliver their experiences back to the Creator. And then in turn, those souls are recycled to have other experiences. And the interesting thing about that idea is that if you really think about it without being repulsed by it, it suggests that the underlying purpose for all reality is growth of consciousness, expansion, the extension of self into new limits. And this is probably true in every strata of existence. I mean, what happens when a lowly little insect dies? Is there any reason why the essence of that little being can't also contribute to this overall experience? Or how about a plant? How about even mineral objects? We just don't know. But it seems evident, at least on our plateau, that consciousness is what it's all about. And if the whole universe is an expanding expression of consciousness, you would think that it would be the duty of people in general to become aware of this and to aspire toward it with all of their energies. That's what I have to say about your question.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm in agreement with what you said. When you mentioned the pyramid, you caused me to recall some experiences that I had when I was living in Europe, and they're directly related to the pyramids because of a book that I had read, and then the fact that I had studied yoga with the author of this book. The book was written by Elisabeth Heich, or we would say Elizabeth Heich in English, anyway. She was a musician and artist, sculptor, or sculptress from Budapest, Hungary. And she had a recollection of a past life in Egypt. And so she wrote a book called Initiation, which described her recollections of the experience of awakening, going through a program which allows you to, let's say, become a spiritual adult. And it's quite a bit different from being an adult in today's society. We're talking about someone that's awakened, that reaches Nirvana or Samadhi, these states of consciousness that just seem to flow through you all the time. And she opened a yoga school with Selvarajan Yasudian in Zurich, where I was living. And I was talking to a friend one day about this wonderful book I had read, and he informed me that they were teaching there. And the essence of what you're saying was something that came through this teaching. There was no limitation. It wasn't just hatha yoga. In fact, they taught all types of yoga, but it was really a spiritual experience. Unfortunately, both of those individuals passed away. She passed away in 1994, and Mr. Yasudian passed away in 1998. But they had this look or this attitude, outlook on life, even in their passing, that they were going back to meet the Creator, but to be consumed, to bring their essence into the whole. And when you were talking about the bugs and the plants, it reminded me a lot about what they taught, because they taught consciousness by being, not necessarily by doing. There's a certain discipline in yoga that is mind over matter. You learn to open up all the channels of energy in your body and in your mind and make this spiritual connection. And once you do that, you don't want to go back to the mundane lures of everyday society. They become very meaningless, and yet you get a lot of satisfaction out of being able to perceive those things from a different perspective, like you said, outside the box. And later on, when I moved to Italy to do some work there, I found that they had created a summer retreat there that I was able to attend just for 1 month because of a heavy work schedule. But they were very, very creative people, and they had struggled through a lot of tragedy in the beginning of their life. And to see them rise to the levels of appreciation and respect from their, not just their peers, but from people who were looking for someone who would teach them without becoming cult figures, if you understand my meaning. They just taught for the love of teaching. And everything that came out of their mouth was truth. There was no hocus pocus and no dogma. But that, I think you would find that book, if you haven't read it, Initiation, or in German, Einweihung, which means initiation.
Well, actually, I did read a book called Initiation, but it must have the same title and different subject, simply because of the fact that the way you're describing it doesn't sound like the one that I read. The one that I read was actually an introduction to a facet of alchemy known as elemental magic. So it must be a different book you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. No, this was.
I wouldn't mind reading it, though.
Yeah, this is the experience, really, that very much ties into the mysticism. Now, this wasn't practicing mysticism, but it ties into or parallels with what was going on in Tibet and what the Nazis tried to tap into as their organization was growing and preparing to bring the world into its Second World War in modern times. Of course, there have been many of these wars. They just like to keep everything in the near past as much as they can, keep us blind to what has preceded us and keep us in fear in regard to where we're going in the future, all the while ignoring that it's all one big now. So I just thought I'd mention that, because you would really enjoy this book. I'm sure you'd get something out of it.
Well, if you don't mind, you can email me the title and the author. I'll look for it.
Okay. Will do.
But anyway, here we have a really interesting situation. I mean, If you look at the tragic history of the United States, and in a lot of ways it is very tragic, we've only been around for a little over 200 years. We're floundering all over the place with more problems than you can shake a stick at. We have all these financial difficulties. We have problems in ethics and in business. We have all kinds of cultural unrest. We have all these problems with various races that live here. It's just an endless series of commotions that we are forced to embrace as normalcy. Now, if you look at a culture that's lived, I shouldn't say lived, that has existed for 3,000 plus years, even though they eventually ended in their pure state and were taken over by others, they must have been doing something right for a very long time, not only because they persisted for that duration, but also because of the impact that they left on humanity. As I mentioned, you know, these places still have an awe, they still have a mysticism, they still command, a whole orchestration of emotions that are inexplicable when they're visited, which is the reason why it's one of the largest tourist attractions in the world. And so, you know, it stands to reason that we have to wonder what it was that they had that was different from what we had, from what we have. And fundamentally, it had to be something that would affect everyday life of these people on all different levels. And they were very cognizant of death, but they were also very cognizant of this function of rebirth and recycling. And those passages that I quoted to you were definitely reminiscent of their philosophy. So consciousness and the desire to expand upon it is a very important issue with these people. And if you look at the achievements that they have in mathematics, in art, in architecture, in music, in just about every facet of life, as an engineer myself, I can tell you, it's one thing to go to a school and learn how to do something, like, for instance, mechanical engineering. Somebody hires you to help them design machinery, whatever it may be. And you draw upon a whole series of lessons that you were exposed to and a methodology of thinking that you were exposed to in university. And you made that part of yourself over an 8 or 10 year period, and now you're free to utilize that information, you know, in your chosen field. Well, that's fine. But there's more to it than that, because once you reach the point where you can release yourself to the higher mind, or whatever you choose to call it, the God consciousness, here comes true inspiration. Here comes the knowledge that is not in the books, the knowledge that is not taught in universities, and all of the stuff that we are free to then act upon in a creative manner to produce new knowledge, new experiences on the earth, new devices, new degrees of freedom for civilization, and progress in general. If this function did not exist, where would the information come from that is being taught in the universities and all these different subjects? Surely people are wise enough to realize there was a time when it wasn't there. And it represents, a cumulative effort of thousands and thousands of different lives, all using their lifelong energies and experiences to make a contribution to the general knowledge pool, which is what the universities draw upon, which is then given over to people that are interested in learning this stuff. But we don't seem to stop and think that this is the same process that happens on the other side of the fence. When we surrender up our lives, we're doing the same thing. We're going back and essentially bringing information to the main source. So here on Earth, we're imitating a process that was invented by the divinity, and we're not even aware of it. This is where one of the amazing things about the way we live, we do so many things that we're just accustomed to doing them because of habit. We don't think about it. But in the ancient times, they made a big to-do about all this stuff. They used to say, as above, so below, which means that everything we do here is essentially an imitation of a function that's already been initiated by the Creator. And so, yeah. you need to think about these things and realize that the world seems to be designed along these lines. Why fight it?
Yeah, well, if I may say so, the statement you just made, as above, so below, has been twisted to mean the opposite. It's quite insane what's going on here when you consider that what you're describing is a process of expansion and elevation to a higher vibration, and yet the experience here dictates that is not allowed. That is not permitted. Which, is another form of insanity. Somehow that we are supposed to accept technology or things that are offered to us, the ownership of which comes about through one's labor and toil to benefit the coffers of those that create these things. And they're just diversions. They're meaningless diversions. All illusions. So, the system, I'm going to get to where I want to rant here, but the system is designed to hold us back. It's as if the life experience is intended to be replaced or to operate similarly to a 24-hour tape loop in a convenience store.
Mm-hmm.
24 hours is up, reset the tape, or just let it erase what happened before. There were no robberies, then you don't need anything that was on the tape. If you get my meaning.
I get your meaning 100%. I mean, this is the reason why for me at least, it was impossible to live a standard life. Let's call it that. Simply because I couldn't envision such a thing as doing the same thing every day. The way I used to look at it, quite bluntly, was I couldn't see the point in learning one particular thing so that I could do that particular thing every day for the rest of my life so that I could earn a living that would allow me to continue to do that same thing up until the day that I died. And then I'm lying there on my deathbed, I'm looking back over the course of my life, and I'm forced to say, what the hell did I do? Now, maybe some people are very comfortable with that, but it drove me insane. And so I had to find my own way, and it's been a really nonlinear path, I'm here to tell you. But on the other hand, it's been a very rich and rewarding experience. Because I chased the dreams, I chased the inspirations and the feelings that were instilled within me, through this creative process. And I did it at great personal sacrifice, but also with a great deal of joy because I believed in them. And I still do. And I will always proceed this way until I croak, because I believe it's the right way to live.
Mm-hmm. You know, going back to Mr. Yasudian, he used to talk about people that he knew of in India that lived not up to 100 years, not 150 years, but 200, 250, 300 years. And he would say that those people achieved a certain level of consciousness that they did not have a preoccupation with death. Or, you know, they knew that it was just a transition to die. The Federation that we talk about from time to time on this show, the United Galactic Federation, the elders are 500 years old or older. And these illuminated ones here running this planet have the secret desire to live forever, yet they break every law in the universe. And their own insanity is, and how it's mirrored in the chaos on this planet, is a perfect testament to the fact that they are totally wrong in their approach. It never ceases to amaze me how little value is put on life. You know, as a child, I could never imagine that people would intentionally kill other people. And as you get older, you're conditioned to accept that people die, and then people die in war, and people are murdered, and then people are murdered senselessly. And then when you really get into studying what's going on, you realize that this is planned, premeditated, by those that lead, even though they give us laws to abide by that would give us a death penalty if we violated them. And even that's changed now, where there's no value on life, that a criminal can live forever in prison or even be released on parole to go out and murder again. You know,
that's because it suits their purposes to do that. Look at the insanity inherent in this new health care plan that they're trying to push through. I mean, I could talk about that for a long time, but rather than deviate too much from the central theme of this show, I will just interject this one amazing thought that comes right out of that document. They actually envision that if this new health care plan is embraced, that the government, and it says this in black and white, will have the authority to address your case when you reach a certain age. And they'll look at your achievements, they'll look at your health, and they'll make a decision as to whether or not you're allowed to live any longer. Imagine the audacity.
Well, and, you know, yeah, it sounds like we need to make that decision about them right now, doesn't it?
Oh, please don't get me started on that. You know my feelings.
Yeah. Jim, I hate to interrupt you. Let's come back to this. We've got a caller that's been on hold for a few minutes here. Noella in Canada. I know how much you like calls. So, Noella, welcome to the show. Question or comment for Jim Murray?
Hi. Merry Christmas to both of you.
Thank you.
The topic you were starting the show with is exactly what I've experienced in the last 3 months. Although I was awake at 5 years old and then life had its way with me, I didn't have a near-death experience. Mine came from the hard knock school. But I'm sitting on the floor here with a bunch of dirty laundry and I'm in total bliss because I made a connection to the source. And I haven't lost it and it's wonderful. And so
now,
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Dirty laundry that made that connection, or?
Well, let's put it this way: it's so blissful that the negative things around me are sort of like bouncing off like bullets.
Oh, that's
it's like my battery's been charged, but in a good way.
And how did that come about? By what Jim is saying?
Yeah, and I don't know why, except that everything was taken away from me, and I totally surrendered, and now I'm in service, and just watching the magic, and I've seen UFOs, and I've seen things that are in different dimensions, like it's like doorways are opening, and I'm enjoying it and welcoming it. So I just wanted to encourage you that it is happening, even to little housewives like me.
Well, that's nice to hear.
I don't know what else to say except hooray.
Well, there you go, Jim. You have a fan.
Well, I was very intrigued with that, and, you know, frankly, I'd love to hear more about it, because I believe that this goes on lots of different levels. The problem is that a lot of people are afraid to even talk about it because they're afraid of what their neighbors are going to think, or...
Oh, that I've gone through that already. My family love me, but they think I'm a nutter, and they think I'm from another planet, but that doesn't bother me either. They're just all asleep. I just see them as all asleep, so I don't judge. And just hopefully that eventually they'll wake up too.
What planet do they think you're from?
It's like some of us have to be in the forefront, you know?
What planet do they think you're from, Noella?
Well, I don't know. My whole life has been crazy since five. I mean, I've seen spirits. I've seen my brother's astral body while he's sleeping below me on a bunk bed and trying to figure out how he could be in two places at one time. And no one to talk to about. And following spirits out into hallways thinking they're like little tooth fairies, you know, and then realizing, nope, that's not a tooth fairy. And all this went on throughout my whole life, but then, you know, you go to school and it shuts down.
Isn't it amazing how when others perceive us as not being like them or like not being like the masses, that there's something wrong with us, and that somehow that closed-minded idea gives them the ability to discern that? It sounds kind of insane, doesn't it?
That it wasn't what was happening to my other brothers and sisters, except for one. So it was sort of like a secret between the two of us. We just kind of knew not to say anything. We weren't believed if we did. And we were raised Catholic, and that was like a no-no, you know, dogma.
Well, you did mention one thing, which I know is a very important ingredient in all of this, and that is that when you reach that point where you feel and understand this other presence, you mentioned how you surrendered to it. And that's really the key to the whole business, because if you literally give up your life, you might say, in service to the cosmos, that's when these things really start to take off.
Well, to be truthful, Jim, I did sort of like a life review before I surrendered. And I guess, basically, to put it a nice way, I said, I didn't do a very good job with this life. So I think God knows what he's doing, because, like you say, he has the whole plan in front of him in the now. So he knows the choices are there for us to choose. But my own will got in the way, and the ego had its way with me, but... I was more like in the victim role most of my life, but I also had a warrior role because I had this secret life. And it's kind of funny, but the secret life was what kept me sane from the normal life. It was the
opposite. Well, actually, that's not so funny. I know exactly what that feels like. I've been there.
Okay, because I kept saying, no, this world is all wrong. People don't do this to each other. And then you'd have a wonderful experience, let's say, with an angel. And that felt more normal to me than what I was seeing with my eyes as a child.
Mm-hmm.
It was like I was in a nightmare. When am I going to wake up?
Yeah.
And I even told my mother when I was five, Jim, that I was not her daughter. And she got furious with me. Because, of course, she was my mother, but I knew she wasn't. It was strange, and I was adamant about it. Like, and it wasn't in an insulting way. It was like a child saying, this isn't my home, yet I recognize it, but it's not my home. And that's how it started.
seeing the deeper truth behind the life experience, and probably even conscious.
It was like I always knew
another
there
time
was something wrong, not quite right, but everybody around me felt it was okay. So that kept confusing me. You know, I if I was okay by myself in nature and all that, I was fine. As soon as I got around people, and I was picking up their moods and their feelings, but I didn't understand I was. I kept thinking it was mine. Yeah, it's a lot for a kid to handle, especially when there's no one to talk to about it. And you're like, and then you go to church and you don't understand what they're saying. Half of it was Latin when I was a kid, so I just sat there and looked at all the pretty hats until church was over. That's about as much as I got out of it, but I did get the messages from Jesus, which to me was not the same. No,
yes.
That's what I followed, the truth.
Yeah, I was going to make a remark in that regard. Isn't it interesting?
Yeah. It's like Jesus was the only thing that talked to me. And the rest of it was too political, or there was fighting going on. But I liked his words because they were, I don't know, they were deep, simple, but truthful.
Mm-hmm.
And they made sense. So I stuck with him. That was my religion.
Well, look at how a message of love and peace has been transformed over thousands of years into nothing but war and death and destruction.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a shame because people, like they say it, they made a bargain with the devil. You know, when you lose everything and you realize you didn't lose anything, it's not even real. And you get caught up in this world that's not even real. And once you realize what the truth is, and when you make the connection, it feels so natural that you go, God, that's what I've been missing all my life. And you go right back to when you're a kid, and it feels like when you were five and playing in the sandbox, totally happy, and one with everything, and nothing bothering you. You know, that's the feeling you get. But you're now, like you say, a spiritual adult because you take on the responsibility with that. That's the price you pay, but willingly, joyfully.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I have to say, guys. I feel like I'm on a pulpit.
No, that's okay.
And I don't like talking on the
about,
radio.
You know, you have to bring your truth to the show, too.
Well, you know? I felt like, geez, this is resonating so much with what's been happening with me. I had to call it. Okay.
Well, I'm glad
so
you
I did.
It.
Hopefully I didn't bore you too much. And,
no, not at all. I mean, you could feel free to call us anytime we're on the air, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, well, thank you for that.
As long as you have something to contribute, that makes it fun.
Well, yeah, sometimes you're scared that, oh, they've heard this 100 times before. So I only talk from my truth, you know. And if anyone gets out of it anything, just trust your instincts and your heart and don't fall for the fear. That's the trap.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not real, so what are you worried about? It's all going to be okay. I really feel that.
Don't underestimate the power
God's
of
game, right?
Your message.
So, anyways, thank you for letting me say my spiel, and good night, guys.
Okay, thanks for calling in.
Night.
Yeah, I just want to say we have a tendency to underestimate the power of our message, maybe because we ourselves don't have a radio show or people don't know us. And so we think, well, we hear these voices on the air night after night, and there's something special about that. Now, we're not really special in any unique way other than we're just doing or we're leading by example, if you want to put it that way. We're offering a perspective that's different from the one that's been offered everyone else. And hopefully that opens up people's minds and hearts to other possibilities than the ones that are rammed down our throats every day, 24/7. Jim, go ahead.
No, I'm in a perfect agreement with you, and it was very interesting, too, some of the things that she said. I know that a lot of my friends, once we get talking, you know, they'll remind me almost in an annoyed way Why is it that every time we get on these subjects, you always wander back to the, you know, events that happened in the earliest part of your life? Well, the reason is exactly what this woman was talking about, because there was a clarity of mind. There was a pureness of existence and a an all-pervading peace that existed in those early days. And it draws you back, not so much because of the sanctity of childhood. I mean, a lot of people have rough childhoods. But because you miss that quality of life that you had at that stage. And I often ponder my existence and try to figure out where did it actually get lost? You know, where did it get entangled? And I actually have to agree with that, what that lady said. I noticed, well, I did have one major event that I know interfered with that tranquility, and that was the death of my grandfather. But over and above that, I would have to say that the next thing that I really noticed as an impedance to sustaining that contact came when I went to Catholic school. You get all this other stuff pounded into your head, and the first thing I noticed, and I used to get in trouble just for bringing it up, everything's a sin. Doesn't matter what it is. It's a sin. Everything's a sin. So, you know, it's like, well, wait a minute. This doesn't make any sense. You know, all the things that they're complaining about are natural things that I've been experiencing all these years, associated with bliss and trusting in the design of this world. And now I get opposing messages. And I think that that's part of the thing that causes you to shut down. You know, your emotional part of you, the more sensitive part of you, I don't think deals well with conflicting emotional energies.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is it nulls out. And maybe it's never allowed to come back if you're damaged severely enough, or maybe it just goes into a quiescent state until such time that you resolve the issue. But, you know, those two conflicting forces like that, which are applied simultaneously, is basically the foundation for neurosis.
Well, yeah. If I can say so, Jim, what you were describing about childhood and that point where everything seems to take a turn for the worse. Well, from the time, you know, you come out of the womb and the doctor's got a hold of you behind, from the ankles and whacks you once on the rear end, as if saying, whispering in the ear, breathe might not work. You know, you're sort of slapped into submission from the moment you're born and a total stranger doing it to you, nonetheless. And then you're separated from your family. You're taken into another room, and you're prodded and poked and injected. And every time you express yourself, every time you engage in self-expression as a child, out of total innocence but with a zest for life and a total spiritual awareness as to what's going on, maybe not able to translate it into thought or into speech, but certainly receptive and perceptive, you become discouraged quite quickly because you're told that those things aren't discussed or those things aren't to be even thought about. So this is a prison planet. This is a suppressed society. Jim, we've got another call. I want to let you respond to what I said too, but we've got Dr. Christopher Holmes on the line. Dr. Christopher, welcome to Evident Footprints.
Yeah, hi, Don. Thank you. And thanks, Jim. A very interesting conversation this evening. And you touch on you know, the subject closest to my heart, which is the study of consciousness, which is you know, Don, my area of expertise, and I explained in my work about how I think in the last century in the West we've been fed what I call the head doctrine, the belief that consciousness is produced by the brain and that it's centered in the head, and how in all the spiritual teachings of humankind, it is said that consciousness originates from the heart, and that the origin of I, or self, is through the heart. And when children are born, it is said that, like, the heart grows first, and when you're an infant and child, your consciousness is centered in the heart, and you see that in the heart, the bliss sheath, and you see the blissfulness in an infant. But then as a person grows up and is conditioned and has life experiences, more and more the ego and the mind develop in the head, and the head becomes to dominate. And that's why we have the head doctrine in modern science. Mm-hmm. And mystical teachings teach that self-realization involves the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. And you can see that a little bit in the lady Noella who called in. Like, I've met Noella in Ottawa here, and she's someone who feels that inner blissfulness of the heart because they've had those essential experiences of self-realization. And then as that happens, you live in that blissfulness of the heart. And the light of the heart then illuminates the higher faculties of the mind and awakens your third eye or your crown chakra or your throat chakra. And you have these other supernormal experiences.
Yes.
So that's just to comment on the heart doctrine. And one last thing, I think there's an interesting story Gurdjieff tells about the nature of the soul. And he was with a young boy, and there was an oak tree outside of his institute. And he asked the young boy, how many nuts are there on the ground? And the boy said, well, there's, you know, thousands of acorns around the oak tree. And Gurdjieff asked him, how many of those acorns will become oak trees? And the boy said, well, I don't know, maybe just a few, maybe none at all. And Gurdjieff then explained, we must study nature to understand ourselves. Just like an acorn can become an oak tree, so also a human being can acquire their soul. But it's not guaranteed and given to everybody. So in our lives, we have to acquire awareness of our soul life. It's not an automatic thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the nuts, in a way, they go back into the ground and they become fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, I think our aim in our life is to acquire this consciousness and cultivate that in our life. Thank you.
Dr. Holmes, if you're not in a hurry, I'd like to ask you a question, and I'd like for Jim to comment on this too. What do you tell a person? You know, we're telling people to go into their heart, okay? Most people relate to the heart as a place where disappointment resides, or where it's broken from disappointment, from experiences that turned out other than how they would have wanted them to turn out. What do you tell people to get them on the path? I'm interested, and I'd like to hear Jim's comment on that too.
Okay, I think consciousness in the body is connected to your blood flow. It's not produced by neurological activity at all. It's related to blood flow through the body and the oxygenation that takes place through the blood. In Genesis, God breathes into man a living soul. So your soul life is very connected to your breath in your body. So what people need to do is go into your body and try to experience yourself throughout yourself within in your blood flow, which warms up your body. And if you go into that deeply, you come to that place where the peace path is all understanding of that. And that's the lowest level of the breath life and the soul life in the body, is that state of that peacefulness. So you can come into that through breathing and sensing your body. Too much people think meditation is in the mind, in the head, and that's all wrong. You want to feel in your heart and in yourself and just surrender your mind, the false ego that just wants to talk and think and chatter. So I would connect it to breathing and reestablish your breath life, because whenever people suffer emotional traumas, they always hold their breath. That's what happens. You hold in your feelings, and people do that chronically, and then by the time they're adults, no one breathes properly anymore. They breathe only shallowly from the upper chest. So you have to reestablish deep breathing patterns and breathe through your body while feeling your blood flow. And if you do that, you regenerate yourself from within without through the dynamics of the electrodynamics of the heart and blood flow. That's how you regenerate your physical form.
Yeah, you're describing the process of tapping into the life force.
Yes.
And acknowledging that it's there and allowing it to expand or to multiply, to grow. Jim?
Yes.
Do you want to comment on that?
Well, I'm familiar with the process that the doctor is describing. As a matter of fact, when I was younger and had a better connection with all of that, there are exercises that I used to do when I was involved with yoga and stuff that definitely highlight that, almost to the point of being scary. You can definitely, and I agree with him also, by the way, that the idea of a mantra or just some kind of mental activity with stillness of the body is not the best form of meditation unless you're trying to achieve something special. But to get back into the body proper, there's this whole routine of total relaxation and allowing your consciousness to visit every part of your body, actually seek for hidden stresses and tensions, release them, and encourage the blood flow to that area. And then, you know, when you eventually do this, not only to all of the musculature, but then you go down your own throat into your insides and do the same thing to all your organs, you eventually reach this amazing state where you are conscious of the fact that you are not your body. And I don't know how to describe it, but the body has a sensation of like pins and needles, only it's not the annoying type, like when your arm falls asleep or something. It's a very, very subtle little...
it's a tingling of energy.
Tingling, yes, and you're coupled into this energy field when you do that. But you also can regulate your body functions under those conditions. Slow down the heart. Your breathing goes almost to nothing. And when all of this happens, you're on the verge of actually stepping out of the physical shell.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't need to go into it any more deeply, but I'm just saying that I definitely concur that's the way to... consciousness is many different things, but, you know, we are locked into this body of ours, and after a while we start to believe that the body is us. And that's a good way to find out that it isn't. Because once you come to that realization, you understand that there is more to your experience than just the physical. Wouldn't you say so, Doctor?
Oh, I guess he's done. Yeah, no, I absolutely would agree. I mean, I know fully myself. I'm not my physical body. I realize that, and I just to add one comment, and then I'll close off, and if I might, is just a quote from Madame Blavatsky from The Secret Doctrine. And you know how the Illuminati are so into, like, they're into mystical and occult teachings. And essentially, they follow what she calls the doctrine of the I. And you know their symbol of the Illuminati. And she says, the doctrine of the I is for the crowd. The doctrine of the heart for the elect. So Blavatsky claims that the heart doctrine is a higher magical occult teaching than the doctrine of the I of the Illuminati. Because, see, they bypass the heart and they're not established in the heart, but they acquire occult powers through the development of their astral body. They're taken by what's called the astral light, which is a lower level light. Mm-hmm. So they think they're so illuminated, but they do have a lower teaching. And I think on the planet today, what we need is the awakening of the human heart among the peoples of the nations to collectively come together to deal with these people and imprison them for their crimes and reestablish justice on this planet. And I think in the next 3 years, that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, I agree.
So I'll let you go, and thank you both so much for your show. Goodbye.
Thank you for calling in, and have a Merry Christmas. I don't know if you heard that, but yeah.
Well, you can repeat it.
Dr. Holmes has been a guest on the show a few times. We have to have him on again, too.
I think it would be interesting if he would agree to come on maybe on a Friday and the three of us cover a topic together. That would be very interesting.
Well, let's see if we can do that.
I mean, he sounds like he's very well informed in this area, and it's always exciting to have cross-pollinization when you're exploring a subject.
Yes. I wouldn't put it that way, but maybe I should, yeah.
Well, there's certainly nothing wrong with it.
Just as long as it's not with the Monsanto GM.
Only you, Don, would come up with something like that.
Well, it's the reality that they're trying
yes,
to create.
It's one of the unfortunate realities that we have to contend with.
Yeah. Now, you know what's refreshing about these two calls, Jim, is that, you heard a totally honest, open expression of consciousness from those that are in the consciousness. The awareness, and taking the responsibility for it too. There are all kinds of ways that we can deal with issues that are going on in the world, and it's I'm glad we're talking about this tonight because it's important to remember who we really are, not who they want us to think we are or who they want us to experience. The fact that they set up these realities for us, what we call the matrix, and we're just supposed to focus all our attention on that as if that's all there is to life. That's the only possibility for life on this planet is what they say. And I say, who the hell do they think they are?
Well, actually, the thing that's even more fundamental on that issue you just brought up. when you're young and innocent, and you're spiritually awake before all this trauma hits you, your natural tendency is to expound in a way that relates to who you really are. Because it's beaming out of you. And the biggest assault that does the most damage is when you are attacked by someone, and it's usually a parent or a guardian or a teacher, but when you are attacked for being you. And the interesting thing is, that is 99% of the time exactly what happens. The way they get you in the mold, or try to get you in the mold, is they attack you for being who you are. And once they kill that spirit, it's just like breaking a horse. After that, they put the bridle on you and they lead you around by the nose until you finally cave in and die. Then they shove you in a box and say, next! So if you can survive that first set of assaults without too much damage, you wind up in a category that is very, very different from the average person's life.
Yeah. Now, if you look at that from the perspective of their population control, Agenda 21 and Rex 84 and Codex Alimentarius and all these meaningless phrases that they come up with that are just codes for their evil plans, where's the logic in that they can't manage a world with 6.7 billion people, So they have to reduce it immediately to 4.7 billion people. Somehow they can manage that number, but they can't manage 6.7 or 3.7, excuse me. Their goal, their immediate goal is to get rid of 3 billion people. Ultimately, they want to get rid of 6.2 billion people based on the number on the planet right now. And, of course, I don't know how they can even count with all the illegal aliens roaming all over the planet and all the off-worlders roaming the planet, shapeshifters and cloned. I mean, you know, where do you draw the line? It's total insanity what we're experiencing right now. It really is. It's just totally insane how anyone could expect that to somehow fix itself from within the problem itself is beyond me. Those that have created it are not the ones that we should be looking to repair it. It's just like asking a habitual liar to start telling you the truth.
Well, the irony of it is they're actually trained to do that, and they do it without thinking. Look at the so-called socialist movement in this country. You have an awful lot of people who really and truly believe that the government can supply all your wants and needs. And they're as nutty as fruitcakes, because the government can't do anything.
All they do is
one thing that the government does that they do successfully. The only thing that they really do is lie, cheat, steal, and murder. Outside of that, they can't do anything. And God forbid that there is actually some sort of a calamity of a physical nature on this planet, those people will die off first. Because they can't do a damn thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, saying that, I'm not criticizing you for saying this, but pointing out the truth in what you said, that those people that expect the government to give them all these things, the government just creates debt. And what are they giving us? They're giving us debt. But people are under the impression, the misconception, that they're giving us something to be valued. They're stealing and robbing us blind and telling us that we have to pay for what they've stolen. And they're going to take that and steal it. Or give it to themselves.
Well, actually, you know, people are very one-sided, or they see through one eye, as they say in Italy. You know, the problem is that when you're on the receiving end of a welfare check, which is being given to you by the government, it's pretty easy to come to the conclusion that the government is your benevolent guardian. But you have to see the bigger picture to understand the whole thing. In order for the government to hand you that check, they got to steal it from somebody who's working. If everybody went on welfare, how long do you think the system would stand up?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's actually a form of slavery right there.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're being forced to work for the guy down the block who's sitting on his porch drinking beer and receiving welfare checks.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to ask General Jeremiah once about how other planets within the United Galactic Federation, how they handle issues of crime and issues of corruption, particularly in the government. Those people are removed from the planet. They're taken elsewhere, and they stay there. And it seems to be a very effective means of creating a real peace and doing away with war and murder and all the pillaging of society that goes on under the guise of democracy, under the guise of health and welfare and doing God's work when nothing is further from the truth than what they do.
Well, we used to have penal colonies on Earth, too, you know. They've been frowned upon in modern times because they're politically incorrect. But there's nothing so far removed from that idea, except that you're doing it on a different planet. You just have a penal planet. As a matter of fact, one of the Star Trek series was based on escape from a penal planet. So I don't see that that's such a far-out idea. As a matter of fact, it's a great idea.
Yeah,
we could start shipping tomorrow.
Yeah, they were sort of mimicking Earth, weren't they? And that they were describing the situation here.
Probably.
They just gave it a different name. I remember that episode, but couldn't tell you what the name of the planet was.
No, but they had a very good-looking shapeshifter in that particular episode.
Really? Dare I ask, male or female?
Well, that was the conundrum. I mean, she started off as a beautiful woman, and it turned out it was something else altogether. But that's part of the problem when you're dealing with those creatures, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, very interesting discussion tonight, Jim. We're about out of time. However, I'm doing a show next week on Christmas night. So really it's the morning for those of us on the East Coast and anywhere east of the East Coast. If you're game to doing a show next week, I'd love to have you back.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I need to discuss my upcoming schedule with you in private, and we can make that determination.
Okay.
So I'll give you a call over the weekend, and we'll resolve that.
Okay, very good. All right. Well, interesting discussion. We could go on for hours, I'm sure. You can't deal with the totality of the life experience in an hour and a half, but we touched upon some important things. Want to thank Noella for her call and sharing her experience, as well as Dr. Christopher Holmes for his. And if you're listening, Christopher, we're going to have you on with Jim Murray sometime here, and we'll get into a roundtable discussion, or maybe a triangular table discussion. How's that? Just to be outside the box.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, you have a great week, Jim, and have a Merry Christmas coming up, and hopefully we'll see you here next week.
We'll work something out.
Okay. All right, good. Folks, you've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com, Wind Talkers Radio, and blogtalkradio.com. Special thanks to those folks around the world tuning in. Those of you in the U.S. military, be safe. Have a wonderful holiday, if that's possible, where you are. We look forward to your safe and speedy return. And just be safe. Know that you're in our prayers. Special thanks also to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me again next Monday when our special guest will be Dr. Atru Ott. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.